Next item on the agenda is Dr. Bob Orr, Virginia Institute of Marine Science, annual review of the status of submerged aquatic vegetation. Sir, the floor is yours. Welcome to the new headquarters.
Thank you. These are fantastic facilities, and thank you for letting me go on. As I said, I've been a member of the Gloucester County Board of Supervisors, and this is my eighth year, and today we're having this very interesting joint meeting with the school board about money, and it's going to go from 1 o'clock till probably midnight. So,
sorry, I won't be there with you.
I'd rather be doing something else. So, let's see. Where are we going to get this here? Where is that? Well, there it is. Okay. Well, anyway, I really do appreciate your allowing me this opportunity to present my annual State of the Bay SAV presentation to you. It's very generous of you, and I enjoy very much this presentation. It gives me an opportunity to interact with you once a year and also let you know the things that are going on with SAV, which are obviously of interest to you for a lot of different reasons, which we will talk a little bit about. So I'm going to cover a few topics, why SAV, just some boilerplate stuff just to set the tone, the bay-wide status and trends that we had for 2017. I'll also comment about something that's happened in 2018, which is, you know, pretty much common knowledge about the weather, and also how it might influence what we see in 2019. I usually comment about the SAV sanctuary in Chicotee in terms of dredge scars. We did get imagery this year, but I can tell you that in the past few years we have not seen any new dredge scars, so we haven't been able to really actually document it. I'll give you an update on the propeller scarring update, because that's something that you all fund every year, and I think it's a very valuable data set and allows us to keep track of what's happening in these valuable grass beds. And then the last one about the seagrass restoration, seaside bays, again, something that you've all been following very closely. An ongoing project and very impressive project regarding the recolonization of eelgrass in these coastal bays since 1997, and then some actions needed. So starting with that, just very quickly, again, why SAV? Again, a very important resource in the bay that's being used as a biological sentinel. The managers are using this as one of the key indicators, as you see in the press, for assessing the cleanup strategies, the success of the cleanup strategies in the Chesapeake Bay. Again, just to comment that, again, SAV numbers, restoration numbers, are included in both Virginia and Maryland's water quality standards, so that, again, we provide information to both the states of Virginia and Maryland in terms of how much SAV there are in all the different parts of the bay. Again, every acre is counted in meeting these restoration targets. So let me just quickly go through the bay-wide status and trends. So as you know, every year we keep our fingers on the pulse of every grass bed in the bay by collecting low-level imagery of all the different areas of the bay. So all those red lines that you see are essentially flight lines that we have our contractor fly at the appropriate time under the right conditions to give us the imagery that we can then map the SAV. And this is funded by these programs from EPA, NOAA, you know, five programs that fund this. Again, we also provide the information on these very strange, we call polygons. These are the Chesapeake Bay segments. So all those weird names refer to, for example, POTMH is the Potomac Mesohaline segment. So all these different segments have very interesting names, but we provide the information, which will be important when I talk about these fact sheets that we're trying to provide managers. Again, just a very simple, this is the imagery that I showed you last year. This is what we see and what we map from. And again, as you know, all that imagery and all of our data are now available to anyone, and I think has been very valuable for the staff since it's ready. And, of course, we always are welcoming any opportunity for questions from staff if they have any issues about what's going on. Okay, so here we are in 2017. That red line is the total SAV in the Chesapeake Bay. This is the first time that our survey exceeded 100,000 acres. The goal is 185,000 acres, but as you can see where we were in 1984 and where we are today, and you know the ups and downs through the time, which is what happens, the overall trend for SAV populations in the Bay is very positive. So we got quite a bit of press coverage regarding the success of what's going on in the Chesapeake Bay. And if we look at the Bay in general, so over here is the Bay and the watersheds, and these colors represent the different salinity areas. So this kind of grayish color represents the tidal fresh area. So here you can see the numbers in the tidal fresh area, and this includes that big Susquehanna Flats, known, very important area for waterfowl, and one of the biggest beds in the bay you can actually see by satellite, and we've increased there. We had a lot of high numbers here, but this reduction was due to Tropical Storm Irene and Lee that knocked back many of the beds in the upper bay. The oligohala zone, which is a very small area but represents this salinity here, again, actually a small decrease last year, but the big change occurred in the mesohaline area, which is this big chunk of the bay in this color here for the salinity 5 to 18. So this is covering large areas of the Tangier, Smith Island area, and many areas in the Rappahannock where we're seeing a huge recovery of SAB there and parts of the eastern shore. So a large increase. And again, if you look at the numbers on the y-axis, they're in hectares, but the fact is that if you look at, they're different for different parts of the bay. So here we are looking at 25,000 hectares. That's 2.47 times 25,000. That's a lot of grass up there. And then,
may I ask a clarifying question?
Yeah.
So in the mesohaline, do you think a success is water clarity, or what is
it? It's a combination of both. Again, if you recall, and I will comment on this in the next slide, when we analyzed all of our 30-year data set and it was published last year in PNAS, that journal that is one of the ones that published the data, it was a combination of not just water clarity, but nutrient reductions that are coming from reductions of nutrients coming from the watershed. And that was in that paper that we published last year, which I highlighted last year in my March presentation. And then again, the polyhaline zone, which we're all very interested in because this is where all of the debate occurs regarding the stuff you get from aquaculture, and we had a slight increase. And I'm going to comment about these three red arrows. You know, we talk about climate change a lot. These three red arrows represent time periods in which we had very hot summers, and 18 is going to be very interesting in terms of what happened with SAB. But when I reflect about what's happened since I started in the Bay in 69, we've never seen this many hot periods. So, you know, climate change is here, and it's real, and it is affecting SAB populations in the Bay. Maybe not the freshwater plants, but as I'll comment, it is having an influence on our populations of SAB in the lower bay.
And that's for eelgrass. Okay.
That's eelgrass primarily. So what about 2018? So 17 was great, but we are now mapping the 18 data. As you know, it was one of the wettest years on record for many localities. Not only that, hotter than normal temperatures in late June. So what I provide you here is salinity measurements at Gloucester Point across time for 2018 in this line here comparing the average and the median and average the range of salinities for the 2003 through 2017 time period. And as you know, it just rained and rained and rained. And you can see what's happened with the salinity in the Gloucester Point area. And this is very reflective of the bay in general. So not only do we have a lot of fresh water and very low salinities, but here's the temperature data. So there are several points here that I got to point out. And it's very small, but I circled this area because this is what happened in late June. About the same time, we started having very low salinities. So we had a lot of rain, increased the turbidity, and with the low salinities and high temperatures. So the 2018 data is this little strange color here, this stuff here, but it was, again, very hot. 2003 through 2018 is this kind of curve here. 2005 and 2010 are also in here. So these are the three really hot time periods. And what we saw is in the late summer for the lower bay, a major defoliation of eelgrass, unlike what we've seen in 2005 and 2010. Very concerned because I was out there with my staff in October, and just about every blade of eelgrass in the lower western shore was gone. Now, the eastern shore was a different story. We had some very interesting imagery coming from, or I should say underwater imagery coming from one of our colleagues there that showed grass presence. So what we may be seeing is a western shore phenomena. The seaside, which I'm going to show you very shortly, was a very different picture in terms of the success of eelgrass there. But again, this is our concern of what's going to happen in 2019. How is eelgrass going to respond in terms of its recovery? Because while there's seeds there, we don't know how any of the stock, the rhizome stock, might have survived this horrendous or very difficult conditions of low salinities and hot temperatures, which again also was very high turbidity. And just to give you a heads up, this is the Susquehanna Flats. This is what all of the estuaries look like, and this was the best one I can do for the upper bay. This is the Susquehanna River. The kind of dam is right here, and that's a big issue. But this is that big bed I was talking about. But this is turbidity coming from the Susquehanna River, but all the upper rivers, the James, the York, the Rappahannock and its tributaries, the Pamunkey, the Mattapani, and the Potomac, were as turbid. This was about an easier shot to tell you that the upper bay and upper tribs were really turbid for a really long time. How the plants respond, that's what we're going to be seeing this year. So what will 2019 hold? Well, we're starting to look at how we're going to assess the recovery of eelgrass. And then, of course, many of the species in the mid-bay area, which is primarily widgeongrass and the freshwater species. What we've seen from some interesting satellite imagery, because we were not able to get imagery of all the areas of the bay, it was just so turbid that it was impossible to get our flights up because we couldn't get anything. It was just too turbid. So, everyone's kind of asking, how is 2019 going to turn out? So, that'll be forthcoming when we start collecting the imagery, and people will be asking us immediately what we're seeing. And of course, one of the things we do which is really good for people involved in aquaculture, as soon as we get the imagery, it's up online. So when we have a lot of requests for people doing aquaculture and it does involve current data, when we collect the imagery, it's up online within a couple of days after we acquire it. Now, last year, I mentioned about this PNAS paper. The reason why, this is kind of a segue into the next two slides, because we talked about what's happening bay-wide, but the fact is that a lot of the resource managers around the bay are asking us, well, what's going on in my individual segment? So last year, I introduced the idea that we are developing fact sheets for each of these segments. So every one of those is going to have this. So last year, I showed you one. This is the final one. So it's gone through a number of stages. This is the final one that we'll be doing for roughly 65 segments. Some of the segments are combined. So each one's going to have a little bubble up here that's going to be a different color. The color is going to be dependent on whether we think the grass has met the restoration target. So when you look at the density, and this is the Mobjack Bay segment. So here's what's happening in the Mobjack Bay for the different densities of eelgrass and widgeongrass. Here's the goal. So what we're saying is that it's potentially attainable, this restoration target, if we can shoot for really better water quality. This executive summary sort of talks about historical aspects and then brings into focus the current distribution since we mapped it. And then this interesting diagram is, again, for resource managers to see, well, what's happening with the grass. So these little features here represent the two species that we have in the bay, eelgrass, or the Mobjack Bay, eelgrass and widgeongrass. These icons that you have here represent things that are going on in the bay. So we did do some restoration work, so that's a diver planting grass. These things called Seki discs are colored red or green. So red means that the water clarity is getting worse and green getting better. And these represent events. So this was Isabel, and then these are the heat events. And we also put in aquaculture because it's important to recognize that in these segments, we're seeing more and more aquaculture. These little bottom cages represent the aquaculture that's going on within each of these communities. And then this is kind of the bottom part, which says this is what these little icons are. So every segment's going to have one of these. Now, the next sheet, the second sheet, and don't worry about reading all this, but I just wanted to show you that second sheet's going to have what we call the take-home points. So they're going to be whether this goal is attainable, potentially attainable, something about historic coverage, key events that have been influencing the grass and that, and then what we call vulnerability or resilience. So water clarity, the heat events, and aquaculture, because, again, we've got to recognize there are certain things going on within each of these segments we want managers to recognize. And then, of course, a section on management implications. So where we are in that process, we see the light at the end of the tunnel. We're close to getting all 65 done. We're within a few weeks of finishing them up. It took a while, and there were some things that happened over the course of the year that prevented us from getting to the end point, but we are within a month of finishing all these, and they'll be patched together and sent to all the resource managers in the Bay for their use. And again, lots of references. We don't want to overload it with data because there's so much data out there. We wanted managers to have a quick look, and then they can talk to their staff about what's going on with each of those segments. Okay, quickly, propeller scarring update. Again, you guys fund this every year. Again, this all started with the fact that we were watching these propeller scars develop, and we focused on two areas in the lower bay, the Browns Bay site in Pocosin, which we present to you every single year. Again, you know, this is what we saw from imagery in 97. It got us started with working with you and staff and the watermen to come up with an appropriate plan to minimize it. And it worked because here are the data from 1989 through 2018. Again, the number of scars, length of scars that we see for each year. And what we do is, remember, this is what triggered the discussion that we had as to who was grading the scars and what do we do to minimize the scars. And so each little dot represents the scars for a particular year. And we follow those scars to the next year, and which, again, what surprised us was how quickly some of these scars recovered. And so when we met and we agreed that the scarring occurred from hall seniors, that we minimized that and also didn't have to enact any new regulations, just changed the way they haul, has minimized the overall scarring in each of these areas. And so while we do see scarring, you know, for example, here's a scarring that occurred in 2018 from imagery. So there is some scarring. It's not occurring, but it is there. But it's certainly nothing like we saw in the past. And again, you know, if you look at the 17 data, here we are, those scars, they're recovering pretty quickly. So within 2 to 4 years, a lot of these scars recover because they're only about this wide from the propellers. So we're very fortunate that, and again, trying to recognize the importance of, you know, the fishery and the people that are involved in that. So that's where we are with the Pocosin area. The same thing with Browns Bay, certainly much better there than Pocosin. But again, you know, we still see some scars in terms of, you know, the length over time. But again, I think the important thing is people do know we're the eyes in the sky. You know, we watch what's going on. We want to report, you know, what we see to the managers. And if we see anything happening fast, we can always report to you all to see if we can modify that. So it does help to have the money that we get from you to cover this particular topic. Okay, this is my fun part. I love talking about this, the seagrass restoration in the seaside bays. So, again, you know, we've been talking about this for almost 20 years. And, again, there wasn't any seagrass there up until 1997 from the 30s. And we started this program in 97. And, you know, here we are today, 2018, 8,900 acres of seagrass. Now, the black line and these color lines represent the different bays. So this is the total acreage of seagrass in the coastal bays. And so you have Hog Island Bay, which is this little blue color down here. You've got Spider Crab Bay, which is this guy here. And then the blue line is this line here. Anyway, these are the four bays, what's going on. And so, you know, it's pretty impressive to see how much of the bay now has, or these bays have seagrass. These dotted lines represent the areas that we've actually targeted for seagrass planting seeds. So you can see the difference between all these little lines here, and this is what nature has done. So now, I mean, that's a lot of data, and I thought it might be really interesting and neat to show you sort of what's happened over 20 years every single year. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to play you very quickly. Every 4 seconds, I'm going to show you what happens each year. So this is what you'll be seeing. So there'll be a year up here. Here are the three bays, South Bay, Hog Island Bay, Spider Crab Bay, and Cobb Bay. And what you'll see, you're going to see these little dots here. They're going to be light green and dark green. So the light green are plots that we seeded that particular year for that year, 08. And then the dark green are going to be plots that we seeded in previous years. So, and then what you see, these color diagrams here, so they represent the density coverage that we map. Now, there are going to be a few years you'll see a big sign says no imagery. So there were a few years that we did not collect imagery because of the turbidity issues. So, again, you'll see from 1999, I think it's 98, through 2018, what's happened with seagrass. It's pretty impressive. No one in the world has seen anything like what we've seen here in the coastal bays. And, again, a lot of this could not have happened without the support from a number of agencies, including the money that we get from their recreational fishing license board. So hold on your hats. Every 4 seconds, you're going to see this change starting now. 1998, nothing. 1999, few plots that we did back here in South Bay. 2000, nothing mapped yet, but again, we know there's seagrass occurring because of our plots. 2001, the first time we added large numbers of plots up here. 2002, and some plots here in Cobb Bay. 2003, 2004. 2005, no imagery, but again, you can see the number of plots that we're planting are increasing. 2006, we have imagery, so there's a map bed here and now here. 2007, things are really starting to change rapidly. 2008, much more seagrass. 2009, now watch what happens over the next few years. This is really cool. 2010, man, all this stuff. All this is from natural spread. 2011, 2012, 2013 will be no imagery in these 2 days. But again, you can see what's going on here in South Bay. 2014, no imagery at all. But again, all the plots that we put seeds in. 2015, continued spread throughout South Bay and there. 2016, no imagery. 2017, we have good imagery, you know, showing the large increase. And finally, this is the final shot. This is where we are in 2018, 8,900 acres of eelgrass. The really cool thing about this is that unlike the Chesapeake Bay, these grass beds have persisted in these three different hot spells. So what we're seeing, of course, is the fact that these are areas where the temperatures are cooler because of the influx of the ocean water coming in and keeping the beds cooler and, of course, clearer. So we think this is going to continue. You know, where this goes, we don't know, but obviously all the resource, the ecosystem resources that this provides is pretty impressive. This is kind of a neat story. And, again, I have you all to thank for the support and the other agencies that have supported. So let's see. Why does it want to go 18? We're stuck. Okay. I did want to mention something. Last year I brought up the fact that we have seen some of these clad dredge scars that we saw in Chincoteague. They first appeared in 2015. In which we counted 84 scars. I brought this issue up to you all last year, and I mentioned that it might be good for your officers to maybe touch base with that person. And so in 17, there were only 19, and in 18, we did not see any new additional scars. And the scars occurred, these are the scars here, these little circles, and these are the leased areas and then the baler grounds. So most of these occurred in this gentleman's leased area. Some of them occurred in the baler grounds or in areas unassigned. You know, we're hoping that whoever was doing that would recognize the importance of these beds because this is pretty damaging. These are essentially 60 to 100 meters across in that. So, again, we didn't see anything in 2018, which is great. I'm hoping that that continues. A quick update on our bay scallops. Again, a big industry that occurred in these areas in the 30s up until the eelgrass died out. Our goal is to try to restore it. So every year we go out and assess the bay scallop population. This is Cobb Bay, and this is South Bay. Every one of those little red dots represent a place that we go and we assess for the bay scallops, literally by placing our hands at the bottom in these quadrats and, feel for bay scallops. And I know Bo's out there all the time with us, and he comes back with scratches. This is us. We couldn't do it without people from TNC. So we do all this every year. This is based on the fact that VIMS is also attempting to restore the bay scallop by putting adult bay scallops out. And so we have 20 to 40 sites into all these different areas, and we literally cover 4 acres of bottom by hand every single year looking for adult bay scallops. Here are the data for the three bays. The green is South Bay, and we did not do the other bays in 2012, 13, and 14, but then we expanded to all these different bays, and you can see the numbers bounce around. Last year we had low numbers, but this is very typical of bay scallops. They fluctuate a lot. These numbers aren't that great. These are nothing compared to the numbers that if we ever had a sustainable fishery. And whether we get it or not, we've had some interesting conversations about where this industry is going to go. We feel that if aquaculture takes off and does this with bay scallops, the likelihood of getting a sustainable population would be having a higher probability. So we're hoping that the aquaculture industry is listening as a possible third species to develop. It might be a cottage industry, we don't know, but when the species was introduced into some restaurants in Washington, D.C., I understand, very favorably impressed with that. So, again, we're going to continue to watch. It'd be nice if we do get a sustainable fishery. It might be just people going out collecting over a certain time period. We don't know. But, we're trying. But it's kind of cool to see that, indeed, this is happening. The other thing that's happening here, people don't realize the number of brant that are occurring. Now, brant was basically eliminated from these bays in the 30s when there was no eelgrass. There are brant populations that are out of sight in these places. No one's really counting. I wish we did. But we're getting people commenting about the number of brant that are now using these beds in the wintertime. It's pretty impressive. And Brent White's one of them.
You want to tell people what Brandt are for those that may not know?
Birds. I'm sorry. I thought everyone knows what Brandt are.
One of the best tasting
birds around when they're eating yogurt. Jeez. Okay. Sorry, Brandt. Birds. So just quickly, let me wrap up, and I'll certainly answer any questions. Again, you know, water quality is that big driver. You can't ignore it. But climate change is here, and that temperature that we talked about is going to continually play a big role. Where we're going with eelgrass, we just don't know. Widgeon grass is coming back, and it, in many areas, persists year-round. I know last October I went out in response to some concerns people had about an aquaculture farm in Milford Haven, and we went out and ground-truthed all of the beds around that area. There were substantial populations of widgeon grass still persisting in October all around Milford Haven and into Gwynns Island and the Rappahannock. So it may be a species that replaces eelgrass, certainly very dynamic, but again, hopefully with a continued monitoring. And, you know, again, we take great pride in what we do, and in particular, we make sure that we get out in the field and know that what we see and what we map is seagrass. It's really important for us to do that. Again, the scarring is great. We still have low levels. I think, again, you know my story. We've got to keep monitoring. I think it keeps some of the people honest about what's going on, since they know that we would be watching very carefully every year. The coastal base, you know, it is so much fun to see something very positive happening compared to what's happening in the Chesapeake. And it may be that these coastal bays could be the population of eelgrass that persists over time, given we know the temperature that occurs is modulated by what happens from, you know, coming into the ocean. Again, we remain optimistic, and we have to. And I didn't mention aquaculture in any of my talks. I just want to highlight, again, the continued cooperation between VMRC and VIM staff. We know that there are a lot of leases that are going on that have SAV, and we do our very best to respond to questions from VMRC staff within 24 to 48 hours. We know how important that is to a waterman that needs to know, is he going to have the lease or not? And I think it works out really well. Again, our data are available to anyone that wants to see it, and we're always open and available for questions from the staff regarding these SAV issues. And last but not least, action items. Well, money. Sorry. I guess only $20,000. But again,
I guess you need that today too, don't you?
Sure, I'll take it. No, I'm just saying. So the support for the SAV annual monitoring program. I understand that an interesting issue has arisen. I think Mark just told me that we have support from the General Assembly, but there's also Mark had commented this support for some aquaculture testing, because people want to know, can both subsist in the same area? And I think that, you know, whether Mark wants to comment or not, I think it's great. It's an opportunity to address some very important issues that have been raised both by staff and the watermen about whether these two can coexist.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was looking through there, and it was kind of hard for me to read. On that one page you had aquaculture listed in a paragraph about like that.
And yeah.
I think there was some concern in there about the ability to coexist.
Right.
And,
mm-hmm.
Well, I guess what is a little, don't get me wrong, proliferation of what's going on with the eelgrass and grasses are great. However, I think somewhere along the way, if I were in the aquaculture business, and I saw the proliferation of those grasses continue to migrate into areas that obviously we want them there, but mm-hmm. is there going to be an expectation that wherever eelgrass is present, there cannot have aquaculture working in concert with it on those grounds as far as placement is concerned?
Well, I can ask Tony or come up and address that, but again,
I want to hear your position on it.
Well, you know, we're always open to addressing important questions of coexistence. You know, we know it's here, and we're willing to work cooperatively to address that particular issue. We have to work within the concept of the laws and ordinances that are currently there for aquaculture and SAV, and again, with the additional support that we will have to address specific issues. You know, I think that some of these issues may get resolved in the next few years. You know, we're well aware of that. We also know that there are many, many leases that are out there in areas that don't have SAV that could be used but are not being used. So we need to look at the big picture. You know, certainly, you know, in areas like the Rappahannock, it's coming, well, it's primarily widgeongrass, and that is leading to some of the conflicts. But, you know, back in the 60s, the Rappahannock was one of the prime areas for SAV, and it disappeared completely. What we're seeing now is great. But again, just to address your issue, I think that, you know, we're always open and we'll continue to be open to address issues regarding conflicts and how we can develop the compromises that allow both to possibly coexist.
Yeah, because those laws, when they were enacted, and policies, no net loss, SAV, you know, 1205, taking consideration SAV, I don't know what years they were passed, but they likely were in years when their grasses were decimated. And there may come a time where we're so successful with SAV.
I hope so.
Well, I am too, but I'm also hopeful that there is some understanding that the two can coexist.
I think there has been, and again, this is where working collaboratively with your staff regarding what we see in the imagery, what's happening, and again, you know, we take into, you know, we're very concerned about that, and so, you know, for example, areas that might be always a density class one, you know, we might say, hey, you know, there may be an opportunity to work within those areas if we know a history of that site. So again, lots of opportunities, you know, emerging, you know, given the fact that we are seeing this increase in grass, and we are seeing that increase in the number of lease requests to really work collaboratively, not just with VMRC, but the industry.
Good deal. Thanks, Bob.
So, remember number one.
Yeah, I won't. You won't let me forget it.
I know. That.
Any questions of Dr. Orth?
Mr.
Tanker?
The scarring, is there anything, what are we doing to mitigate that? Yeah, I know we're doing something.
You don't need to do anything, because the grass beds here grow really, really fast. And again, remember, back in the 2000 time period where when we were debating that, we went out and did, you know, I thought the extensive studies to actually measure growth in these scars. And even though you don't see them, they are filling in within 1 to 3 years because they're narrow. And because the growth rates of these grasses are, you know, 25 to 50 centimeters a year. So you can just imagine a 100-centimeter scar. You know, with growth coming in from both sides, they colonize pretty quickly. And so, again, you know, we are well aware of that, and we watch them, and that's why we watch the scars each succeeding year in our imagery to see how quickly they recover. And, of course, we're at these sites every single year. You know, we go out and monitor the grasses, and we've got our face in the water to see what's happening. So, you know, not just high level, but, you know, we're pretty committed to being, you know, in the water to see what's happening.
Thanks. Ms. Everett?
I have three questions.
No, we're just getting ready to eat lunch, so don't worry about it.
Just so you remember, I got to be at the school board of supervisors from 1 until who knows what time tonight.
Really quick. So in terms of the 185,000 goal, which 57% is achieved as of
2018.
17. Susquehanna Flats kind of carrying us, and I know you did those various sectional.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't done a study, but just in general, is it
the flats are definitely carrying the upper bay. There is no doubt about that.
But entire bay, I guess.
Well, you know, when we look at the whole bay, I mean, if you want to take, for example, the Chester River, didn't have any SAV in the upper Chester until about 5 years ago, and all of a sudden it has just gone nuts. There's SAV everywhere. So, you know, we watch each of these tributaries. The Severn River in just outside of Annapolis has had a place called Round Bay. Has had persistent SAV in very narrow ranges because, again, it all depends on the depth of the water. A lot of other places, what was interesting, when they had an outcrop of these dark false mussels, it showed the impressive ability of animals to clear water. So during those years when we had these mussels, the water cleared up and we had a lot of SAV, which shows the importance of water clarity. So, again, there are all these different events. I mean, that's one of the things that you'll see in the fact sheets that revolve around places like the Magathie River and the Severn and the upper Potomac River. So, the flats did drive everything, but it's, you know, again, all dependent on where you go. So it's a good story in many parts of the bay.
Two other quick ones. So it sounds like, obviously, climate change with temperatures affecting eelgrass, obviously.
Correct.
But also, too, in terms of fresh water, is also a bigger driver due to climate change.
Well, this may be a plus for a lot of freshwater species. Remember that we've got about 15 species of freshwater grasses. They don't like salt. So, you know, as you get lower salinities, we're going to see the downward movement of some of these species in these areas. But, again, they're very sensitive to salt, so they're only going to be able to penetrate the estuary where these rivers to a certain extent. So, for example, in the Potomac River, there's an area called Maryland Point. That seems to be a very important tipping point for some species that we don't see going further down. So if the salinity increases, it knocks out some of the species that it moves up towards Washington, D.C. So, you know, again, you know, it depends. I mean, 2018 is a year that everyone's going to watch what happens in the 19 time period, not just for SAV, but for fish and oysters and all that stuff. So, you know, climate change, because of the issues that we know from temperature and these pulse events, was 18 an unusual year? We don't know. I mean, right now, it's been raining every weekend, and we have up to 8 inches of rain already. And we watch the Susquehanna Dam because that's a big indicator of what's going to happen in the bay. And that dam has been open almost all fall. So we watch it. It closes and opens depending on the demand for electricity. And so over the course of 3 months, it never closed. And it was releasing water up to 100,000 cubic feet per second for months. So, yeah, it's going to be – 2019 is going to be a year to watch for a lot of different things. So, third question.
And then the final one, the obviously the success story you see in the coastal bays, do you see that potentially being replicated anywhere in Chesapeake Bay? Is there an area where you can say we can do restoration here and it'll take off, or is it just maybe that's
– Well, for the lower bay, you know, we're really resident on doing much more than what we do now, primarily because of the temperature phenomena. We know – I mean, we watch all these different areas of the bay. We have transects that we run every single year in all these different parts of the bay to watch what's happening. And so that those transects and our face in the bottom tells us what's happening. I wouldn't attempt any additional restoration unless I knew for the lower bay what would be happening with, you know, the climate. It's just not worth it. Now, parts of the bay with freshwater, you know, right now I don't think it's necessary because when you clear the water up, there are so many places in these marsh creeks that have freshwater plant species that, you know, these little marsh creeks pump out propagules. And that's why we're seeing such recovery occurring in freshwater areas, like the James River. You know, we see plants now trying to make its way into the main stem James every few years, and they get knocked back by turbidity. But there seems to be this continuing pulse of freshwater plants, you know, trying to make their way into the main stem James, which is pretty impressive. So, yeah, there are winners and losers in this climate change scenario.
And ultimately, we all lose, Glenn, anyway. It's like it is. Further questions, comments? Bob, thank you so much. Good to see you again, and appreciate it. And
my pleasure.
Good luck on your afternoon, because I've been on that side of the fence, too,
yeah,
so I know it can be.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's always this conflict between, you know, us who have the reins of the money and the school board that says give us everything. Then we have to go back and forth. And so right now they're asking for a bunch for a new high school. So that's going to be the big debate this afternoon, is just how much we can give them with that issue, you know, concerned about debt capacity. So, yeah.
I'll save my pearls of wisdom for that for later day. But anyway, yeah. Anything else?
I think Rob's back there.
Rob, yes, sir. Did you send me the message?
Yes. How are you?
Was that in my packet or did I miss that?
Well, at this time, the commission usually approves the funding for the propeller scarring survey.
I asked him if he wanted it today, and he said no. Don't give it away if we don't need to.
Did he say no?
Yeah.
I must have been a long way back there. But that's typically it. But the amount is $22,000, and it's split equally between the Recreational Saltwater Fishing Development Fund and the Marine Fishing Improvement Fund, the recreational and the commercial fund. So,
and the funds are available?
Yes.
Chair will entertain a motion. We don't, this, Rob, this doesn't have to be public noticed. I think I remember all some, everything's good to go?
Yes.
Chair will entertain a motion to
move to approve the funding, however you want to call it.
Motion made by Dr. Neal, seconded by Mr. Minor to authorize $22,000 split evenly from the recreational fund and the commercial fund for propeller scarring and monitoring. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. Don't ask for anything else again.
Well, thank you again for this opportunity. And, again, if any of you have any questions or would like for me to talk to your groups or whatever, I'm always available to make any presentation to your groups. And so, yeah.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will now adjourn for lunch and
enjoy
return.
Lunch. I gotta go.
Yeah, and return, what time do y'all think? It's 12:30 now? 1 o'clock? 1 o'clock? Thereabout.
Okay.
be in recess.